Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by chess.com, the world's largest chess community. And there's a really exciting and new release from chess.com that I've enjoyed using. It's called Classroom. This feature allows you to easily go over a game live with a friend or a club member that you just played. And you can do so interactively on the board with both of you on video talking to each other. It's also a great way to have a lesson between a student and a coach. And you can check that out on chess.com/classroom. Do you want to have an exclusive say in the direction of this show? Is there a topic you want me to cover to help your chess? Or is there a guest you'd love to hear from? That's exactly what you get when you join my online membership, Chess Improver Monthly. You get to vote on this show's topics, guests, and even get bonus interview content from those who appear on the show. And those are just some of the benefits of joining. There's a link to join the membership in the show notes and on the webpage for this episode. So go to the show notes, then click to join Chess Improver Monthly. Welcome to this week's episode. Before diving into my guest introduction, I want to mention that I created a new piece of audio content that's really fun and I think will be helpful for you. I thought about all the great wisdom from guests that I've heard in nearly 30 episodes of this show, and I put together the 7 lessons that were most impactful for me and shared them in this audio recording. It's a mix of guest audio clips and my commentary about them, and it's called 7 Quick Tips for Rock Solid Chess Improvement. I think you'll really enjoy it. The link for it is in the show notes on the app you're using or on the episode webpage of my site, so you can get it in either place. So just click that link and you can download it. If you listen to it, let me know what you thought and I'll respond to you. Probably on Twitter is the best place, but you can also email me. Okay, on to this week's guest. We have the incredible FIDE master, Alyssa Melikina. First, a bit about her background. Alyssa, like a lot of top players, rose the chess ranks in her youth and is now one of the top female players in the United States. Though her story is different than a lot of other top players, and in a wonderfully rich way. She chose to become an attorney, and a successful one at that. But she's still regularly involved in chess. And in 2017, she wrote a superb book called Reality Check, which uses the lessons of chess to help you succeed in your career or business. In this episode, we spend the first 30 minutes exploring Alyssa's fascinating story. Then, for the second half, we discuss the intersection of chess and life lessons. So, this is not my common, quote-unquote, improve your chess episode, but it's just as valuable and exciting. Plus, I think we shouldn't always just be obsessed about how to play better with our chess, but also to see chess in the broader context of our life as well, and this episode does exactly that. The conversation is one of the deepest and most engaging that I've had with a guest, and I think Alyssa is not only a great chess player, but an amazing person and a wonderfully profound thinker. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hi, Alyssa. How are you today?
Hi, Daniel. I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to have you on. I'm excited to talk with you about your career and your book and everything related to chess.
Yeah, but everything in between, we have a lot of ground to cover. And I find myself in a place where I am suddenly an adult chess improver as well. And I think a lot of us have come to that position, but from different backgrounds. So I'm excited to talk about my own journey here and how that can connect to your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested and intrigued that you said that. So, you know, obviously I have some questions that will directly touch on that subject you just brought up. But yeah, feel free to include any insights that you or experiences that you've had, you know, as now, quote unquote, an adult improver, you know, in recent years, that could be interesting for the audience because they love to hear about that, as do I.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have a lot of thoughts. So I feel like I came to the right place for that. But as some of your audience might know, I started out playing chess very early on when I was 7 years old. And I was a child chess player. Went through the scholastic chess scene, played in a lot of international competitions and world youth events. settled on a career outside of chess. I'm currently a practicing corporate litigator based in New York. But throughout my time, I still kept up with chess, was competitive. And then, yeah, one day you kind of find yourself, you know, I'm no longer a child chess star, so to speak. I'm now an adult with a career, but still have a foot inside the chess world. So a big challenge for me recently has been trying to find that balance between keeping up with chess, which will always be a part of my identity, just, you know, how closely I've kept up with the game and how it was ingrained in me from a young age. I feel like I can never completely let a part of that go. But, you know, keeping in mind the realities of what it means to have a career outside of chess and what role does chess play in my life, I think for me has been the biggest struggle in that respect. And that may or may not resonate with all of your audience members who may have a different relationship with chess, but we find ourselves in the same spot. I feel like when I talk to a lot of adults who learn chess even late in life, you know, the biggest question I get is how do you fit that into your schedule and into your life?
Yeah, all excellent points. As far as the adult improver story, I mean, yeah, I think there's always some uniqueness in every person's story. There's always a little bit something different in there that's their own. But at the same time, we all have these commonalities that we can connect with and understand between each other. So I look forward to talking about that with you. We'll dive into that for sure for a while in this conversation. But yeah, let's talk about an element of your story that you kind of brought up already a little bit, which was, you know, learning chess when you were young. Well, let's start with the very beginning. Where were you born?
Yeah, sounds good to go back to the beginning and start from square one. So I was born in Simferopol, Crimea, which, you know, several years ago, no one even knew what Crimea was. Or where it is. It's now apparently become quite a controversial region. When I was born there in 1991, it was still Ukraine, now an annexed part of Russia. And it's strange to see how history repeats itself, because when I was born, I was actually technically still born in the Soviet Union because it had not dissolved by that time. And that was the catalyst for my parents to immigrate out of that region and into the United States. And now, you know, over 30 years later, here we are almost in similar circumstances.
Yeah, unfortunately, right? So the breakup of the Soviet Union at that time, that was sort of the impetus for your parents coming to the United States?
Absolutely. And not just my parents, but there was a big influx of immigration from that region. So you'll see, you know, a lot of Eastern European immigrants leaving the Soviet Union around that time as well, in the early 90s.
I see. And I read that you were only 2 months old when you came to the U.S. Is that right?
I was, yes, just 2 months old. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, I grew up in the U.S., but technically still born in the Soviet Union / Ukraine.
Yeah. So your parents moved here when you were just a baby. And then as a child, your father taught you chess. How steeped in chess was your father at that time when he started teaching you?
That's right. And I owe a lot to my dad for teaching me chess and, you know, keeping up with my chess career and really supporting and encouraging me all the way. So he knew some chess back from his days in the Soviet Union. He was a Class A or B player then. And then once he got settled here and got his footing in the door, he was quite a top dentist back in Ukraine. He had to go through the entire graduate school process here to get his accreditation because it wasn't accepted in the U.S. So he had to go back to school being already a seasoned dentist and head of various institutions there to starting from scratch here. Once he finished that process and was able to get his license and start practicing and open his own business, by that time I was around 5.5 years old. And so I think once he settled there, he revisited his prior passions and decided to teach me how to play chess. And he saw that I was naturally inclined to the game. And so he just taught me the rules to start, gave me a basic chess program, and let me have at it.
Wow, that's really awesome that he kind of rekindled his own passion and wanted to teach you. What were your first memories of playing chess?
Yeah, my first memories go back to having this chess program called Chess Master. I don't know if anyone still remembers it. It was a precursor to Fritz, but it was back in the days of, I guess, you know, Windows 2000 or earlier. But it was a very basic chess program, and by today's standards, I think a very weak chess program. But you know, for a beginner like myself, just learning the rules, it still gave me a bit of a challenge. So I would play with it almost daily. I think we got to the point where he taught me the rules and it would just be a part of my routine where I would go and play this computer. And some of my earliest memories from that were if I did win against the computer, then he would give me a quarter, which in the 90s, you know, by today's inflation standards was quite a bit for a young girl.
Yeah, especially since you can play an unlimited number of games too, right? So there's that.
Well, I had, this one big match a day.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's not like today's standards where I think people just go online and play this series of chess games. And that is still mind-boggling to me as well, the online chess scene. I never got really into playing live online chess. I would usually just play against the computer, but it was in a very controlled way. And even now, I've never really gotten into online chess. And I think that's because I grew up with chess in a very analog and classical way.
Ah, that's interesting. Well, I have a similar experience to that too. In fact, the Chess Master program, I think I know exactly what you're talking about because I'm pretty sure I had it too. The cover of it like had this old guy with a beard, right?
That's exactly what it was. Yes, he looked like a wizard.
Yeah, I had that too. Because I was getting into chess several years earlier than you, but around that time. So a lot of the same resources were accessible to me as you. So I understand the whole, it was like the last decade of, a mostly analog period of chess, I think.
Yes, those were good times. And it's funny that, about that program, I thought that no one would remember it, but you made a good point that at the time there were less resources available. So if you did play against a chess program, there was probably only that one available. Whereas nowadays you can play against almost any chess engine.
Yeah, exactly. So I read that your family also didn't have that much money as you were growing up as a child, and yet you still reached these very high levels in chess. So how did you manage to get that skilled in chess, without being able to afford the usual stuff that goes along with it, like a regular coach and all the travel and tournaments, those are all very costly. So how did you manage to reach that level without maybe some of the same financial resources as some of the people you were competing against?
Yeah, and you bring up a good point because, from the outside, chess may seem like a very inexpensive game because all you really need are the board and pieces. But to ascend, just like in any endeavor, you do need access to resources like chess coaching, and especially playing in tournaments, the travel costs really do add up. And back in the day, there weren't online videos or virtual lessons available. So you really had to find an in-person coach, find a grandmaster, start doing these private tutoring sessions, which of course add up. And we never went through that traditional route. So my dad had, known enough chess to know where to start. And he was very good at assembling the right resources and materials for us to essentially learn the game together and master it together. So he, would have been probably around 1900 when he started teaching me. And so I that was enough of a foundation, but he ended up taking me to master level, by the time I was 16. So we kind of went through those steps together. Every time I played in a chess tournament, he would be at the bookstore looking at the latest releases, looking at what was written in the most concise way in which he could impart it to me. And I think what was most important there was just having a routine. So I just remember my childhood routine was that he would walk me to school every day. And on the way to school, I would recite, these chess basics and these chess principles, like control the center, castle as soon as possible, make sure your rooks are connected. I can probably even recite some of it now. And he would have these lectures for each phase of the game. And I would recite various points of it. He would quiz me on spatial visualization. So for example, name all of the squares on these long diagonals, name all of the squares here. And then after school, we would do more practical based work, just lessons from some of the books or learning openings from some of the books. And I feel like that structure really helped. And of course, we were looking at, you know, very good authors, you know, like, you know, John Nunn and Purdy, if anyone remembers that. And just if you have the right resources, it can really get you far. But I feel like the routine is what made all of the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. So your dad served as your coach for most of those years, it sounds like.
Yes, and he traveled with me to every single tournament until I turned 18.
Oh, that's really, I don't know, that's touching to me. I think that's really awesome and sweet that he was that involved and took that much part of your chess career.
Yes, and part of it also was because he started his own dental business. You know, by the time he finished dental school and he was working for someone else and had saved up enough to open his own practice. And because he had that flexibility as being his own business owner, that he could take the time off that he needed to travel with me to tournaments. And that's another thing that people don't realize, even for kids, is that these world youth events, they take up to 2 weeks and you're traveling to a foreign country. And the amount of preparation that goes into that, you know, that's a lot of time to take off of work. So it's not accessible to everyone. And, you know, he sacrificed a lot to help me with my career.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, well, that's great to hear that he was that involved and helped you that much. And, you know, speaking of your tournament career and all that and everything that went into it, I mean, you got pretty serious about it from an early age. You learned chess at age 5 and then you competed at your first tournament at age 7. I'm guessing it wasn't long after your first tournament that, you know, it became a very regular, serious endeavor for you.
That's how it progressed. Yes. And so we were based in the Philadelphia area, and my first tournament was the World Open, which was then held at the Adams Mark Hotel in Philadelphia. And I guess we were also lucky to be in the right place at the right time, because Continental Chess Association hosts several large tournaments in the area. And that was a big draw for us. I started out playing in the open tournaments in that circuit, and just I really took to the game, started getting good results, was motivated. I got a lot of support from my elementary school as well. I went to public school in Philadelphia all throughout until high school. And yeah, I was just very lucky to find the support there. Everyone encouraged me to keep going. And when you're a kid, you don't really reflect on it. You have the momentum. And then at some point, it just became a part of what I did. I mentioned the routine that I had. You know, that for me was a given. I never really thought about not doing chess.
That's awesome. You've had a long tournament career there in your youth. There's obviously a lot of highlights and cool stories I'm sure we could talk about. I'll just hone in on one that stood out to me for right now. Which was you placing 3rd at the U.S. Women's Championship in 2009 at age 18. That's extremely impressive. And I just want to know a little bit about that. First of all, what were your expectations going into that? That was your first time competing at the U.S. Women's Championship or no?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because, yeah, at the time, it did not feel like it was a big deal. And now looking back at it, it really is one of the highlights of my chess career. But I do think that that sentiment is somewhat related to how well I did. So it was not my first U.S. championships. It was my second one, but it was the first U.S. championships, I believe, that was held at the newly opened St. Louis Chess Club. And so at the time when we played in St. Louis, we had no idea that it would become the chess center it is now. You know, hosting the top elite events with the world champion and what it has progressed to and what it has done for U.S. chess. So we were just there, you know, oh, here's a chess club in St. Louis looking to host the championships. That's cool. But when we got there, and I'm sure everyone has heard of how wonderful the St. Louis Chess Club is, that is all absolutely true. I mean, they really treated us as professionals. There was so much attention to detail. And I think just even being in that setting, it elevates you and your mindset. So I think there was just this big momentum and push in chess. And I believe the U.S. Championships was held after the World Team Championships in China, which I also played, I think, a month prior. So I was really just on this chess tour. And the World Team Championships, is probably my biggest chess achievement to date, which is getting the gold medal for my performance there. And then also playing in China and the Chinese Federation, they treat chess players so magnificently. Even going there was like being on in a different world. And then going to St. Louis shortly after was just a continuation of that. And so just suddenly getting, seeing just chess rise to this level, I think I was just riding on that high. And I didn't really think about what the U.S. championships meant. You know what the saying, when it rains, it pours. I feel like I find that that happens with success, also with negativities, which is what that expression refers to. But that was the summer before I started college in 2009. So I was very active in chess that summer, did a lot of back-to-back tournaments. Then in the fall, did the World Team Championships and also did the U.S. Championships in St. Louis, and just had a pretty successful several months up to that point. And sometimes you're just riding the momentum. And then sometimes, you know, if a tournament doesn't go your way, then it feels like everything is just collapsing altogether. So I find that that's interesting with chess, is that you really have these points of ascension or have these points of dissension, but I haven't really had as, you know, spotty performances. It usually comes in waves.
Interesting. Interesting. So this was your second U.S. Women's Championship that you attended. Yeah. The reason I wanted to ask about it is because from a competitive standpoint, a human standpoint, I can see it either way. Like for some people, third might be a crowning achievement in their competitive career, regardless of whether it's chess or not. And other people might go into it saying, oh, I expected to win first place and I only got third. So I can kind of see it from either side. So that's why I was kind of curious, like what expectations you had for yourself going into the 2009 U.S. Women's Championship and whether you felt you exceeded them or didn't quite reach them.
Yeah, that was also my first time really playing in these adult, if you will, level tournaments, because up to that point, and I had just turned 18 then, my entire chess career was based on the world youth competitions and championships, and I was competing against people my age, and I was quite competitive there, and so I was not really as familiar with or prepared for going into the open circuit, so I came in with no expectations. I came in just for the experience, you know, and I played in the prior U.S. Women's Championships before it was held in St. Louis, which to me seemed more like a regular tournament at the time, just, you know, another tournament that I would have at the event. And it was still wonderfully organized and still a very positive experience there. But of course, St. Louis just took it to the next level. And so I think before St. Louis really came on the scene, I mean, for me, the expectation was, okay, the U.S. Championships is just another tournament on my calendar. I didn't really think about it. And I think it's only in hindsight where they just really elevated these championships that you realize, wow, I played there and I got third place there. And that means something.
Yeah. Well, from where I stand, it's pretty amazing. Third place. I mean, not actually even more so now, considering that like you weren't, you know, it's not like you were like, oh, I'm 6 months out away from this. I'm going to do everything I can to place, you know, first or something like that. It was just the next tournament for you and bam, you got third. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. And I find that that's when you do the best. And they say that's the same for, you know, things like exams as well, is that when you're not really thinking about it as much and are not in your head is when you do the best.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So now let's talk a bit about your career and career paths. You know, you ultimately chose a full-time career in law, graduating from the University of Pennsylvania in 2014. You know, you have this very high-level chess career that you've done pretty much your entire life before going into law school. So at that, in my mind, that kind of critical point before you enter into law school and decide, yes, I'm going, did you consider a path forward with chess? I mean, a full-time path forward with chess in some way? Or did you already just kind of know, I'm going to find a career other than that I'm going to do, and it's just a matter of which one?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's also not something that I reflected upon in the moment. And I think I'm glad I didn't, because I don't know if it would have swayed my path either way. But at the time, even in the U.S., it wasn't really common for there to be, you know, career chess professionals. And I do credit, you know, the rise of chess with St. Louis Chess Club and all the other initiatives for, making that possible and bringing chess on the scene. But at the time, I just grew up with chess, but I was also, you know, this type A, very perfectionist personality, ambitious in everything. So same time I did chess, I started doing ballet lessons, and I was very serious about ballet, and I still dance, and I'm probably doing more ballet than chess at this point, and more dance, and that's a big part of me. And so whatever I devoted myself to, including academics, I had to be the best at it. So while I had that chess career progressing, you know, in my academics, I was getting straight A's and, you know, the testing at the top of the class. I was doing science fairs. I was competing in the academic sense as well. And so I think that that was always going to be a priority, but I never thought about it as a choice between chess or academics or chess or career. For me, it was all going on concurrently. And at the time, I thought I would be able to do it all.
Interesting. Yeah, I bring it up in part also because of my recent conversation with Bruce Pandolfini on this podcast, and talking about his career path with chess and being a coach and all that. And he highlights how in the 70s, you know, that really wasn't an option for most chess players, was to make some kind of full-time career out of it. But I mean, you know, if you fast forward to today in 2022, it's happening all over the place, you know, where you no longer have to be like a top 20 player to do that. And, you know, you see a lot of masters and IMs and things like that finding ways to make it a full-time path. And so it's interesting to me that even maybe around that time in the early 2010s, I guess you could say, that still really maybe wasn't as much of an option even then as it is now.
Certainly, it wasn't at the forefront of my mind. I know people had been doing it, but I didn't grow up with the sentiment that it was possible. And so I think if it were presented as a possibility, I might have shifted or pivoted or focused more on chess. But I also think it was more personality based and the decision based on the fact that I would never be able to fully commit to just one endeavor. I think if I were a professional chess player, and I know it takes so much, I have so much respect for them, it's a full-time job. And I don't think people realize that, but, you know, these people are studying 8 hours a day, constantly keeping up with the latest games, the latest theory, running the engines to the max, making sure that they're finding the latest novelties and that their openings are 100% foolproof. It's a lot. And then, you know, they may be coaching on the side or playing in tournaments and preparing for that. So there's a lot that goes on. It's very mentally taxing. And even if it were possible for me to make a career out of that, I don't think I would have been happy doing only chess. But in order to get to the top in chess, that's pretty much what it takes. And in fact, that was one of the catalysts of writing my book, Reality Check, which at which point I reflected on different career paths and decisions. And that was definitely a factor. And I talk about that in the book as well, which is, would you rather be a jack of all trades, which is more of how I see myself, or, you know, a master of one. And the problem is, you know, if you're a master of one, yes, you're the best, you're at the top, but you always have this, you know, nagging feeling, you know, what if I did this? Or the problem is that if chess is your whole life and you lose one game, it just hurts so much more. And losing in chess already hurts a lot. And I have very terrible loss aversion as it is, even not doing it full time. But imagine if that's all you did. I don't think I would have been able to stomach that and move forward. Other people may be more resilient. So I think I settle on the path of having a foot in multiple options.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Alyssa, that you said that, because, and that's kind of why I'm asking these questions, is because while you didn't, as you say, pursue that full-time competitive professional chess player career, you still do a lot of things within chess, even though you are a full-time lawyer. And so it did strike me that, you know, you still kept that very much a part of you in what you did with chess. And another thing that was interesting to me that you just said, you contend in your book that society rewards the specialist, basically, as far as careers go, but that you see yourself as someone who wants to do multiple career paths. So square that, if that's the phrase, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. And that holds true even within careers. You know, people want specialists over generalists. And I had always just, you know, been interested and involved in many different activities. And that's a lot of what the book is based on. In fact, the preface and the introductory chapters are about exactly that, which is accepting which competitive endeavor you want to pursue. And that is actually the hardest part of it. And that goes to motivation as well. And that is really the crux of, I think, continuing on and improving as an adult player, is deciding that that is what you want to do. And that decision, that's the hardest part of it. And that's still something I grapple with now, because, you know, if I play in a chess tournament, I will have to be devoted to the chess and prepare. And I can't use it as an excuse to say, well, you know, I'm not a full-time chess player, so it's okay if I lose or don't do well. I can't do that. I have to be fully invested in it. So it's just something that once you pick a lane, you go with it, but you have to be really good at taking a step back at those critical moments and coming in with different sets of expectations. So now my expectations, you know, if I were to play, for example, in the US Championships, would not necessarily be that, okay, I have to win, because I know my limitations. I know that given where I am, you know, in my life, it's not feasible for me to win, but what else can I get out of this experience? And that's not a natural thought process. And even growing up as a competitive chess player, you know, you want to win at all costs, and you do what it takes to win, and you prepare to win. So it's very counterintuitive for me to take a different approach, but I feel like that approach is necessary to continue on.
Well, yeah. And I think this is relevant to the adult improver audience that is listening right now. And what you said, you know, earlier about how you wanted to relate some of your own story to them, because I think they have to do the same thing. I mean, while they're not at, they and me are not at your skill level in chess, it's a similar situation where you have to find more satisfaction in chess than just the winning that may happen or may not happen, because you can't give every hour of the day to it like a professional can. Does that sound fair to say?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. And I relate to you, and I feel like I am a one of you as well with the adult improver community, that you really have to manage your expectations going in. And that's very difficult for a lot of us, because I think a lot of us come from similar paths where once we commit to something, we want to give it our all and give it our best. And so it is a bit of a blow to the ego to realize that, you know, I'm not going to be the best in this particular way. But then you have to go back to your roots and think about, well, why are you playing chess at all? What are you getting out of this game? And how can you maximize that given the experience that you have? And, you know, you may find that the answer is, it's just not worth it for me to play in tournaments or to compete at this level because it's too emotionally taxing. You know, I can't stomach the losses. And if so, that's okay, because there are so many different ways to enjoy chess. And as you touched upon, you know, a lot of my chess career has been outside of strictly the tournament circuit, and I still get a lot of joy out of that as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love hearing that. And I think that's a great lesson for everyone listening. And we touched briefly on your book, so let's actually go into it a little deeper now. For those who don't know, in 2017, a few years into your law career, you wrote the book Reality Check. My very quick summation of it is, you're extracting lessons from chess that can help people succeed in business or their career, you know, applying the lessons of chess into those endeavors. And my first question about the book, I have several, but my first one to kick it off is, you know, you already had a thriving legal career at this point when you published it and wrote it. What made you decide to write this book that covers that subject?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And that is a great characterization as well. It is a bit difficult for me to sum up as well what the book is about, because it's about so many things and it relates to so many people, but in different ways. So I touched upon this a bit earlier about in terms of what the catalyst was for writing the book. And I think at some point I did start reflecting on the career and where I am. And as I mentioned, you know, when you're a kid growing up playing chess and you just do things on autopilot or you go with the momentum and you're not really thinking about, well, why did I decide to go this path and not this path? You know, why did I decide to play in this tournament? What does this victory mean to me now? Once I started reflecting on that and just analyzing my thought process, I realized that the way I think is very different from other people, even though we all end up in similar places. So, you know, the people I end up with in law school or at aspects of my legal career or even in chess tournaments, and we all get to the same place, but the way that I come about it is different in terms of the way I approach problem solving, in terms of the way I handle and react in high pressured situations, in terms of do I lead thinking rationally versus with my emotions, you know, am I more open-minded about certain aspects? Am I always trying to see the other side? Am I always planning ahead? And just thinking about that and talking to more people and getting exposed to more people and thinking about how they think and how they came to the same place just through completely different circumstances, through their background, or they were already integrated into this successful community and just did that because it was expected of them. I realized that I learned a lot from chess along the way and that I owe a lot of my success to the mindset of a chess player. And it's not necessarily that, oh, you know, I know these chess openings or I have these chess victories on my resume that helped me, but it was more about the thought process that I grew up with as a chess player. And it really carried over to other aspects of my life. And I had, at the time, I was doing a lot of disparate chess articles, you know, I was writing for Chess Life and Chess Life Online, and these themes kept coming up. And I was one of the few chess players at the time who, you know, was very competitive in chess, but also had this other career in the corporate world. And so I would get a lot of these questions about the overlap between the two. And at some point I figured I just need to get all of these thoughts down and find the commonality in the explanation. And then once I started thinking about it and reflecting upon it, it all came together in this cohesive way.
Yeah. And one thing I didn't mention in my introduction to your book here in this part of the interview that I wanted to mention, which is that it's fantastic. I absolutely love it. I think it's fascinating. I've never read this kind of book before. And I mean that in the best way possible, where I don't think there's someone who's kind of tried to find the intersection of business/career and chess. It seems like a completely unique book that's on the market. And I just want to commend you for that, because I mean, a lot of books aren't original, and that's okay. But this one truly is original, and you have phenomenal insights. And I just wanted to say that to you, because I do think people should read it. I think it's incredible. I think as chess players, which is the audience we're speaking to, really, I think we'll really enjoy just learning how to succeed in their careers better through the prism of chess. I mean, that's just something we're going to naturally gravitate to and love. And I think you're the only one really offering that.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's very gracious of you to say. And that actually means a lot to me, because you and your audience are the exact audience I had intended for my book. And I was worried, because it, to me at the time, it sounded like a niche, you know, how many people actually have these issues where they're balancing chess and, you know, careers outside of chess, or are coming to this point where they have to make a decision. But in terms of the response that I've gotten, it's all been very positive. And even, you know, from professional chess players, they got a lot from the book as well, because it highlights aspect of the chess mindset and thought process that is not obvious. And, you know, they read it and they say, oh, I actually didn't realize that, but that was a pivotal moment in my career when I came to these crossroads, and I actually do think like that, and that can help me outside of chess. And then with people where chess is not their main priority, but they're pursuing other endeavors, you know, they get to appreciate chess in a new way and think, oh yeah, like I actually have been thinking like this and I didn't realize, but I do have chess to thank for some of this. So in a way, the book is a lot like me in terms of, you know, I'm a generalist and mm-hmm. I have a foot in various doors. So in this way too, the book has a little bit of everything for everyone, but I hope that I was able to tie it up together.
Yeah. This wasn't exactly a planned question that I had for you, but I'll bring it up now because I think this flows from what you're talking about. As I've dived back into chess myself heavily over the past, getting close to 2 years, I guess it's still closer to about a year and a half right now, I see a lot of potential deep lessons that chess has to offer for life. But at the same time, I feel like it's really easy to spend a lot of time on chess and yet still not maybe see those lessons or apply them to your life necessarily. In other words, it may not be an automatic transfer. My thinking has been that if there is lessons, but it's a little more conscious and deliberate. Like if you look for them and see how to apply them, I think it can help you a lot in life. But I don't think it's just handed to you on a silver platter. I think we have to be a bit conscious about it. I know you said that there's instances where it does seem to kind of influence our thinking automatically. But I just mean kind of more broadly. In general, I feel like there's a lot of lessons to be had if we're conscious about it. And I wanted to get your opinion on that, and also to say that I think your book helps with exactly that.
Thank you. Yes, that was one of the goals of the book, was to bring this to the forefront and to people's consciousness. And as you've alluded to, once you're conscious of, for example, you know, your inhibitions or your impediments to optimal decision making, that's the first step in solving that. And even once you figure that out, it doesn't mean that you'll wake up and overnight you'll optimize your decisions and your rating will jump 400 points. It'll still take a lot of work, but I think that the most difficult aspect is pinpointing what is holding you back exactly. And that takes a lot of work and a lot of introspection, a lot of unearthing. And throughout the book, I go through these different phases of things that will hold you back from improving at your optimal level, whether it's at chess or whether it's in other parts of your career. And those impediments can come in the form of your cultural influences, which you may not be aware of until you reflect upon, expectations from society, including expectations about what counts as success or not. You know, that's always a question that I grapple with, and that is in the background in the book. And then in the last section of the book, I go through the ultimate impediment to success, once you've defined it and accepted the definition, is yourself. And so a lot of the book is overcoming obstacles that people put upon themselves, such as biases, you know, bad habits, some of those like you've already mentioned, but also things like not embracing failure, not being willing to learn from your mistakes, you know, having self-doubts creep in, or on the flip side, being overconfident.
Yeah.
And people, you know, they go through life or they play through a chess game, and we're making so many decisions, you know, at such a high rate, just every single minute, that, you know, it's impossible in the moment to kind of analyze yourself as you're doing this. But if you take some time to step back, I think once you reflect on this and you're aware of it, at least it's just one thing that you can overcome. And so for example, I talk about in the book, self-doubts, which happens when, for example, like myself, and I'm sure a lot of your audience, you don't have as much time to devote for chess, but you may play in a big event every now and then. But if you haven't looked at chess in a while and you come to the chessboard, you know, the pieces, they don't feel the same. You're not playing as smoothly or as quickly. You're using a lot of time. Even if you're sharp, even if you studied your openings, if you're just out of practice, you start to doubt yourself. You start to overthink. You start to recalculate lines where you should only have went through them once through calculation. That eats away at your clock. Or if you have an advantage, you're not confident that you can convert this advantage. And so I'm very aware that that's a weakness in my chess, is once I have an advantage, it's not as easy for me to see it through. There are a lot of games where I had, plus three and it ended up drawing. Sometimes it ends up losing and that feels the worst. And even though I'm aware of that, and I'm aware that I have these self-doubts, and I might have the self-doubt because I didn't prioritize chess enough, so I'm coming into the tournament cold. And so, you know, I'm aware of all this. It doesn't mean that, you know, the next day I'll wake up and I'm suddenly converting all these games and gain 50 rating points that instead of losing them. So after pinpointing that, then the next step is, okay, so this is a weakness of mine. How do I improve this? But that for me is the easier part, because there are books written on the subject. I can look at videos. I can talk to stronger players. I can analyze my own games and look at the critical points at which I should have converted an advantage and I didn't. And I started doing work like that, and it has helped. But that is still a process. And chess is always a process and always a journey, and there's always more to learn from it. And that is one of the lessons as well, because similar in life, you know, you never really stop improving or stop growing. And especially for your audience, the premise of the show is that the adults who are listening do actually want to improve and do care about getting to the next step, whatever that is.
Yep. So a couple of things that I wanted to mention. That's all great stuff. So what you're saying, the experience that you talked about with the converting an advantage that you have and having trouble with that and then figuring out how to solve that problem, So you're basically saying that that's like a, there's a lesson in that and how you approach difficulties in life, right? Like that it's the same process, basically, identifying it and then looking for solutions.
Yes. And being a chess player, you know, it introduces this process in which you can tackle problems like that. And I think that's a benefit and advantage we have as a chess player, because many people, when they're put in these situations, they don't have the tools to deal with them, whereas we can distill it to a very process-based way. Mm-hmm. And so if I see something similar coming up, you know, in other aspects of my life, I almost have, you know, this point where it's like an aha moment, and yes, I'm ready, and this is how I'll tackle the problem.
Interesting.
Which again, when you talk to, you know, non-chess players or even just high achieving people who don't think like that, I think they react to situations differently. And even if they're able to overcome it, they're not as process-based.
I see. So you find that, so basically you're giving one example of how in your own life you found that you are much better at maybe just even knowing that a problem exists and how to solve it, but also that you're much more systematic and process-based once you do identify it than a non-chess player.
Yes, and I like that you use those words, systematic and process-based, because that is how I would describe how I think, and a lot of the lessons from my book, and even, you know, you were talking to me earlier when we were setting this up about my course on iChess, about the Melahina method, which actually is exactly that, which is more of a system-based and process-based approach to chess, and not everything has to be memorized or worked through rotely. You know, if you have a process and a structure and work from that, that can go a long way.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention, and maybe it's a slight tangent, but I just wanted to comment on the chess part of what you said, because I really, really sympathize with that. And it's interesting to me because I don't know, you're something like 1,000 points higher rated than me, but I have the same struggle. At a different level, but a similar problem. Like when I get into winning positions, maybe if I'm even up 2 pawns in an end game or close to an end game, I think in my head, oh, this should be a breeze. I should plow through. Or even if I'm up a whole piece, I feel like in a certain way, I put more pressure on myself and say, well, this should be something I should coast through to the end now. And it rarely is. And it's really hard. And then I get frustrated with myself that it's not easy. And I feel like I'm doing something wrong if converting the win isn't easy. Or converting the winning position isn't easy. And so just wanted to sympathize with that and throw that out there and talk a little chess since, you know, it's a chess podcast.
Yeah, definitely. And this problem recurs at so many different stages of your career as well. You know, just because you're a master doesn't mean that you solved all your chess problems. And even if you're a grandmaster, you know, unless you're, you know, 2800, there's always still things that you can work on as well. Maybe they just come in smaller doses. But it sounds like what you're going through is more, you're a bit more overconfident when you get to a winning position. Whereas I struggle with the opposite side of that, which is I'm more pessimistic.
Oh, interesting.
And so when I get a winning position, I'm like, oh no, here it goes again. I'm going to blow this winning position. I'm going to lose a pawn up. And how terrible will that be?
Mm.
And for me, that causes self-doubts because then I'm almost fulfilling that prophecy.
I see.
So I cover that as well. And I give a few games and analyses, especially in the appendix to the book, because like I mentioned, it is it has something for everyone. So even if you are a proficient chess player and you want more of the chess content, I go through the analysis and introduce some of my games and some famous games to highlight some of the points I go over. And there's a lot of chess content in there as well. But it's if you're not very chess heavy or you like reading more words than lines, then the core of the book is more of the substance without the actual chess or variations.
I see. Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me how psychological chess is. For as much emphasis as we put on just the logic part of it, you know, or just studying pure, I don't know, tactics or strategy, the psychology that goes into all of it is endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, and you can learn a lot about human psychology just studying chess players or studying the dynamics of a chess game, because it does bring you to this point where you can make decisions in real time and with pure information. And so if you can ask yourself or ask other chess players, you know, you made this move at this particular point, why did you do that? I think if you go to chess players at different strengths or different stages in their careers, you'll get very different answers. I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, for sure. So we talked a little bit about some of the lessons that chess gives and how we can apply that to life, specifically business and career, but maybe even more broadly than that. But I would love to talk about a lesson from your book, a lesson that chess teaches us that we can use for life, and pick one or two that you're using actively right now in your own life.
Sure. Yeah. And depending on at what point in my career or what state of mind you ask me that question, I might give a different answer. But I feel like one of the lessons I've been appreciating more and more, especially as I get older and progress in my career, is that in pressured situations, remaining calm and objective. And I found that if I'm confronted with a problem or, you know, there's a moment of panic or something goes wrong, so my initial reaction is actually more so to just freeze up and have a moment to process and intake all of the information and only after that act on it. So it very much overcorrects to overreacting, if you will. So rather instead of overreacting, I'm almost underreacting, but using that time to process and come to a decision in the way forward. And that is very different from how most people react to pressured or very stressful situations. And I found that that helps me a lot to, you know, keep a cool head and just also be very, very efficient and keep things moving along.
I see. Yeah. So,
and when you're a chess player, you know, of course that is something that is very important to, you know, for example, you're playing a game and time is running low or your opponent introduces a move that you weren't expecting. You cannot have, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to that. And I think most chess players don't. They kind of see it as, oh, well, that was interesting. I see why my opponent played there. She might be planning this or this. And so how do I respond to this? What's my next step? And so that's how I've always intook those types of situations. And when you see some input or stimuli, you know, outside of chess happening in the same way, that's my initial reaction to responding.
I see. And that's one that's active for you right now. Like that's current, that's a lesson that's in your book that's relevant right now in what's going on with your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even practicing in the corporate setting and taking on, you know, very high stakes matters and situations, and kind of my first reaction to something is always to just treat it objectively and as a problem to be solved.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think that's a great lesson. And again, to me, it's one of those ones that, you know, maybe we can kind of condition ourselves with in chess and just become better at it in the rest of our life. But, and maybe that is true, but I think just being aware of it, however much we apply that lesson already, I think if we're aware of it, we'll be even better at it. So, which is another way of saying people should read your book because I think it helps bring a lot of these types of lessons that you're talking about to the forefront of our mind. And we can be much more proactive in applying what we learn in chess to our life.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, once you learn a lesson, you have to actively practice it. But like you said, once you're aware of it, you can tackle it. You can improve it. If it's a weakness, you can inhibit it more. But I feel like if you improve yourself as a chess player, you're naturally working on these skills. Right. So I think once you get to a certain level, say 1800, you know, when you are confronted with new positions or new moves you're not expecting, I think in order to be an 1800, you inherently just have to see things objectively. And so the two go hand in hand. So there's also a case to be made that, yes, it's worth working on your chess and progressing in your chess, and that will naturally spill over into benefits in other parts of your life. Or you can approach it from a more strategic way, like you were saying, where you are more conscious of these things and then actively try to implement them.
You know, I'm sure you've had a lot of people tell you how you're book impacted them positively in their life. Do you happen to just off the top of your head have like a favorite story of one of the lessons in your book and how it positively impacted somebody?
Yeah, that's a great question. I always enjoy hearing from people about their responses to the book or even to my story. I think I've talked to a lot of adult improvers who have said that they've gotten this fresh perspective on chess and this new motivation to keep going and finding other ways to get involved and to stay with the game. And I just find that very rewarding because, like I mentioned, you don't necessarily have to play in chess tournaments or you know, get to master level. And there's just different ways that you can stay involved. But I've spoken with so many people that, you know, after hearing me or reading my book, they say that, oh, I played in my first over the board chess tournament, or I, you know, got an online account on chess.com and now I'm active every day. And they just find these joys in chess. And I think it really enhances their life.
That's great. I love that. Yeah, that is definitely a big theme for adult improvers, which is just different ways they can enjoy the game besides, as we mentioned earlier, besides winning or seeing a rating climb. I mean, those two things are great, but it is awesome when you can find other ways to enjoy the game. One thing that I want to ask you that's related to the subject again that we said we would dive into of you being in the club of adult improvers now as well is balancing your multiple interests. And that seems like maybe two of the biggest ones right now for your legal career and your chess life. And this is a similar struggle for a lot of the adult improvers who listen to the show. As we mentioned earlier, they, you know, they have their own careers. And at the same time, they're trying to find time for chess and get better at it and find ways to improve and enjoy the game on limited time, maybe less time than they would like for it. So how do you manage that? How do you juggle those interests?
Yeah, that has been a persistent question for me for the past several years now. And also it is in the background in the book as well. But I think, you know, my relationship with chess now and where I've come to it is finding a way to integrate it into my current life and just going back to my roots and thinking about why did I start playing chess to begin with and what did I really enjoy and take away from it and trying to distill those aspects. So, for example, you know, this major benefit of chess from a young age was getting the ability to travel the world. Very early on, I played in the World Youth Events. It took me everywhere, you know, from South America, Argentina, Ecuador, Europe, Spain, France, Turkey. I mentioned I played in China, traveled all over the U.S. too. And that was always a wonderful experience. So now in my adult life, you know, when I'm looking for tournaments to play, actually one of the things that I'll look at is the location. And to see if I can combine it into a vacation trip as well as a tournament. And that takes some of the pressure off of the tournament. And then I also feel like I get something out of it and I can enjoy the tournament more. And then I can enjoy the vacation more as well, because I feel like I'm doing something productive and reconnecting with the chess.
That's great. And how about like just day to day? Or maybe not day to day. Maybe that's too small of a time frame. Let's say week to week or month to month. How do you find that balance? And you know, with chess and law. I mean, I guess I'm assuming in that question that you spend some time, maybe playing or studying the game weekly. But I don't know.
Yeah. So my favorite thing to study or train, if you will, are solving chess puzzles, and that's another aspect of chess that I really loved growing up is just the logic of it. And there's nothing quite like a beautiful combination where it's a forced sequence and it just works out in your favor. And I wish that I could harness that and that all chess games would be like that, you know, it would just be like one big chess puzzle. So, you know, like whenever I have some free time or on the subway or I'm on the exercise bike and, you know, I pull open the app and do Puzzle Rush and I actually quite enjoy it. And for me, it's, you know, stimulating and it also helps keep me sharp because one of the things I realized, and I mentioned this earlier, is that when you take a break, and then you go into a tournament again after a while, you're not as sharp anymore. You have more doubts creep in. And part of the reason was that I just, you know, wasn't used to making quick decisions about chess or looking at chess in that way. So when I started doing puzzles again, I'm actually able to play a lot quicker and see the connections between pieces more. I'm just more used to the spatial awareness that you need with chess. So I always, you know, stress to people that keep up with your puzzles. If there's one thing that you can do, let's say you have only 15 minutes a day, just make sure you're doing tactics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can always brush up on your openings or, you know, learn the theory on the openings, but you just need that familiarity and the sharpness.
I think there's something that a lot of us can relate to, because even though, you know, the vast majority of adult improvers haven't gotten to like really high levels at chess, they kind of wish they could. A lot of them do anyway. They gotta, you know, love the idea of being a title player, or even just increasing their rating by a few hundred points is really exciting. And yet they know they have these time limitations. And so they kind of have to make peace with what you can do in the time that you have, right? As an adult, have you been able to do that? I hope that's not too personal of a question, because I know it's a tough one, right? Like, we wrestle with this ambition and sort of the reality of our time limits.
Absolutely. And yeah, not personal at all. In fact, I have a section in Reality Check to that very issue of time management. But my takeaway has always been that once you decide you want to do it, you will find time. So I see the lack of time as more of an excuse than an actual impediment. You know, so for example, let's say I'm invited to a big event, you know, in a couple of months and I have to train. I'm not going to say, oh, I don't have time, because suddenly I'll find pockets of time. I'll find, you know, the several minutes I have in between doing this or that, or on my commute, or I'll schedule it in and I'll allocate this, you know, or I'll look at chess instead of watching TV while I eat dinner. So it's, you can always find pockets of time. You can always, you know, find ways in which you can cut something out and put chess back in. But I think the biggest challenge is that deciding you want to do it. And then once you do make that decision, then I think what can be helpful is talking to an external person, whether it's a coach or just a friend in chess, and saying, you know, hey, I want to devote this X amount of hours in my day to chess. You know, here's kind of what I'm doing. Here's what my schedule looks like. Like, what are your recommendations, you know, for how I should integrate this? And do you have any ideas for what I should be looking at to study more efficiently? You know, that's something that I've been able to do for myself, just, you know, knowing what I need to work on and being aware of the chess literature and how I can fit that into my day. But it might not be obvious for everyone. But I think once you make that decision, the rest is easy.
That's great. I love that answer. I find that actually encouraging and positive, even though maybe to some it might sound like tough love of like, don't make it an excuse. But I like that. And you're in good company with Peter Giannatos, who is, I don't know if you know him or know of him, but he was on the podcast and he made a similar argument about time to basically, you know, be cautious of using that too much as an excuse for not doing what you want to do within the game. So I like hearing that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm definitely familiar with Peter, but that makes sense because he also is, you know, at chess, like, has a very highly successful business and the Charlotte Chess Center. So I would definitely credit his response on that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Alyssa, you've written a chess theme book. You also created a course for iChess called the Melikina Method. Can we expect any other chess or chess related projects from you in the future?
Yeah, I feel like I always have, you know, a few chess projects here and there, even if I'm not actively working on something, something creeps up. My latest project, since some of the literature I've been working on, was the New York City Corporate Chess League, which some of your audience members might be familiar with. And that idea sprung out of, similar to what we were talking about how can you meld your career with chess? And the Corporate Chess League was a perfect outlet for that. And in fact, I, you know, had friends growing up with chess who also ended up working in the corporate setting or at banks in New York City, at other various firms. And we've all come across players at our companies, or I should say, people who appreciate chess, but they're not necessarily tournament players, but they would love to connect with other professionals and play chess. And there was definitely a need for this forum. So the idea for a league was was an easy idea to come up with. Just there was definitely a need for it. And there was definitely already a membership for it because there's so many people who have a passion for chess, but just nowhere where they can get together and experience chess, but also, you know, the networking aspect, because once you talk to another chess player, once you know another chess player, the connection is immediate. You immediately have shared interests, and just the way that you think is similar, the way you approach certain topics and discussions is similar. You know, even Daniel, you and I, just in this interview, I feel like we're on similar wavelengths, and just through our connected interest in chess, you know, we have a lot to talk about. So that is definitely a, you know, a selling point and then why there is a need for something like the Corporate Chess League. So we were active before the pandemic. We hosted a few seasons at my law firm, and they were very gracious and did a fantastic job hosting the event. And it really combined, you know, the world of corporate galas and events with an organized chess league. It was not rated. There was no prize money. There were no entry fees. You know, it was definitely not a profit enterprise. It was just more like, hey, we all want to get together and do this and experience this. And I've made a lot of friendships that way, even just people I was friendly with. And then after going through the league, you know, they developed into very strong friendships, met a lot of people that way. And I think it just reinforces the chess community and is a positive thing all around. Now, it takes a lot of work and organization to pull off, and the pandemic threw a wrench in a lot of it. So we'll see where we end up with it. But I think people are ready to get back to in-person chess experiences.
Yeah, for sure. And I love that you're doing that. I mean, it's just great to hear that. I haven't spent a lot of time in the corporate world in the past decade myself, but I don't hear much about there being chess leagues in that setting. So I think it's wonderful that you created that. Just two kind of easy questions, light questions to wrap up our interview. I don't often ask a non-chess question, but it seems relevant as we're talking about different interests and passions and things like that. Are you still doing ballet at all?
Oh, yeah. I don't get asked that very often at all. So thank you for that. Yes, definitely still dancing, still keeping up with ballet. I think I mentioned early on that once I devote to something, I will see it through. So I think even nowadays, I take a lot of dance lessons during the week and may even devote more time to dance than chess. But dance for me, it's not a competitive pursuit. And I'm not as close to being good at dance as I am at chess, you know, just totally different playing field, definitely more of an amateur there. So that's just something that I do for myself. And I wrote an article for Chess Life several years ago. And, you know, one of the premises of that piece was that chess is discipline of the mind, whereas dance is discipline of the body. So, yeah, there's definitely a common theme to a lot of the interests that I have. But I just, you know, need something that continues to challenge me and that I have a passion for.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I just love that you're a multi-passionate person and that, you know, you've done a lot of dance and ballet and, you're very impressive resume, so to speak. And I mean that beyond just career interest. So very cool.
Thank you. And then, I will just add to that, you know, a lot of people underestimate how much stamina chess requires and how athletic it actually is. And if you talk to professional, you know, chess players at the top, they have a very strict training regimen. So I do think that, you know, it is important to complement any rigorous mental activity such as chess with something more physical, you know, whether it's dance or an exercise routine. And it's about finding that balance.
Yeah, great point. I always welcome and love hearing from any of my guests who encourage that people have an element of their life that's fitness-based, because I do think it's important with chess. When James Canty was on, you know, I don't know how much you know about him, but if anybody knows a little bit about him, they know he's a huge fitness buff. And he said chess is an unhealthy sport, and we need to balance that with physical activity. So I think there's that side of it too. I think it helps balance all the sitting and being, you know, sort of stationary, but also, as you say, gives us the stamina to do the sport itself too. So it's like a two for one.
Yeah. And balance is a major theme, you know, of what we were just talking about. And I think what your audience can relate to as well. And so I think all of life is finding balance, and a lot of that is in chess as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Final question for you. Which of the top chess players or, you know, top level, do you enjoy watching most who are active today?
Sure. Yeah, so I'm still, you know, a classical and traditional player at heart, as I think you can glean at this point. So I always like rooting for, you know, the people that have been around for a while and who I'm familiar with. And nowadays you see, you know, there's a lot of kids who are very talented and very strong, but they seem to come out of nowhere. And so for me, it's hard to kind of, you know, get around that or get on that bandwagon. And I know people love rooting for the underdogs or the new faces, but I'm always you know, for the traditional, because I respect the people who have stuck with the game for so long and are committed to seeing it through, and there's some familiarity with that. So I feel like, you know, if you pit, you know, Magnus against, you know, any of the new young rising stars, you know, I'll still root for Magnus and Hikaru and Fabiano, and, you know, just all of these people who have been around for a while and who I want to keep seeing them succeed.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I love that. That's a great answer. Alyssa, I wish we had, you know, hours more to talk. I feel like obviously the subject could be covered for that much longer, the subjects that we're talking about. But I also just really enjoy connecting with you and talking about this with you. I think everything you do in chess is amazing. And I love that you extend chess to other areas of life. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about the game, is that it can be done that way. But you're also one of the few people who is actively showing us how to do that and see it in that way and learn from it in that way. And I'm just very grateful for you for you doing that in the chess world and everything that you still do actively in the chess world. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Daniel. And thank you for all of the very thoughtful questions and the thorough preparation for this interview. This was a wonderful chat. I feel like we really see eye to eye on a lot of things, and I can talk hours and hours about this topic. There's just so much that chess has to offer, and I've done so much in chess as well. So yeah, like you said, we could go on and on, but I think this is a good place to wrap it. I hope your audience got something out of it. I know we might have opened more questions than resolved them, but that's, you know, part of the learning process as well. And if any of your audience members are in New York City near the Marshall Chess Club, I'm scheduled to do an event with them later in October of 2022, just in case someone is listening to this afterwards. But yeah, check their calendar. We're still in the planning stages, but I think I'll do another, you know, lecture book signing combination, and we'll talk about more lessons that I've learned along the way, like we've been discussing today, and also a more chess analysis component for those of you who want more of the rigid chess in your lecture series. So hope to see some of you out there.
Yeah, that would be great. I hope some people listening can make it. That sounds like a great event. Just one more reason for me wishing I was out there in New York to visit the Marshall Chess Club. But yeah, that sounds fantastic. Hopefully one day I can come out there and visit one of your lectures and attend one of them. That would be great. Yeah, just thank you again, Alyssa. I loved everything that you shared. And yeah, there's a lot more we could talk about. Maybe one day we can. I'd love to have you back on a second time, sometime down the road in the future. You were fantastic to talk with, and it's just a real honor to have the chance to do this interview with you. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. I had a great time, and let's definitely stay in touch and look for more opportunities and more interviews in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.